mentioned the interventions that we can undertake, including some of the controversial ones. It's interesting that humans lack uricase, so we're unable to break down uric acid into more benign molecules. And sustained hyperuricemia is defined as something greater than or equal to 7 milligrams per deciliter in men and greater than 6 in women. A sustained level of that quantity, which is pretty modest, is actually associated in the long term with tissue deposition of uric acid and other metabolic effects. So I will go into in a little bit both of these aspects about tissue deposition and the metabolic effects of hyperuricemia. Hyperuricemia is most often familial. The traditional concept is that there are overproducers and under-excretors, and I think that in part is true. Most of the hard evidence, however, points toward the under-excretion route. There are now several well-defined polymorphisms in renal urate transport proteins and the renal handling of uric acid. Diet has some influence. If you examine non-Western populations, their ingestion of daily uric acid or purines that then are converted to uric acid is about between 2 and 4 milligrams per deciliter's worth, whereas in industrialized nations, it's quite a bit higher, ranging from 3 to 8 milligrams per deciliter. And that is really the baseline uric acid, serum uric acid levels. The influence of richer purines in the diet, as well as higher levels of fructose, have an influence on serum uric acid levels, as well as greater alcohol intake through the population. And this has the effect of inhibiting tubular secretion of uric acid. Higher prevalence of factors that reduce kidney urate excretion, such as insulin resistance, has an effect. Hypertension and its vasoconstrictive effects in the kidney have an effect, and generally a decreased renal excretion function. Then, of course, there are interpopulation genetic differences, and so that is a little bit more heterogeneous in industrialized nations. So all of these go together to point out the fact that the populations that we serve tend to have higher levels of uric acid. Now, there are particular populations, such as Southeast Asians, Filipinos, for example, have a dramatically higher baseline serum uric acid level, something to know about regarding their risk for gout and all of the other metabolic side effects. So the complications are pretty well known. The confirmed ones, of course, are gout and nephrolithiasis, and also uric acid nephropathy. So this is a direct consequence of sustained hyperuricemia. The emerging data, which I'll also share with you, regard hypertension, cardiovascular disease, and metabolic syndrome as a whole. In fact, gout, at least in many minds, should be included as part of the metabolic syndrome, which of course includes hypertension, glucose intolerance, prediabetes and diabetes, hypercholesterolemia, and so forth. So gout or hyperuricemia might be included in that. Still controversial, there are some data to suggest that sustained hyperuricemia has an eventual impact on the development of dementia. That is still work in progress. I saw a gentleman a few months ago who was interesting and presented a little bit of a challenge, or at least got me thinking, as to what to do. This was a 70-year-old Caucasian male, and he came in because he had sustained hyperuricemia, and that was it. I said, what brings you in? How can I help you? He said, my uric acid level is high. I said, okay, well, let's talk about that. Anyway, it came out that at age 54, he had his first myocardial infarction, and subsequent to that, had 3 more MIs. At age 57, he had a 3-vessel coronary bypass. So a pretty aggressive disease, and since then has had 15 coronary stenting procedures. I think his coronary arteries are pretty much entirely metal mesh by now. But anyway, a lot of coronary intervention, but he's doing well. He's currently asymptomatic. He has a pretty good exercise tolerance, and his cardiologist says that he is doing well. Anyway, over the last 2 years, his measured serum uric acid levels have been respectively 8.2, 9.0, and 8.8 milligrams per deciliter. So they're in the moderately high range. Certainly, you would think of something, a level like that, as a risk for gout. And indeed, he recalls having two distinct episodes or attacks of gout, the last one being 15 years ago. So it was pretty remote. He had classic podagra and also inflammation involving the instep of that same foot. The instep is very commonplace as well, involving mainly the extensor tendons of the foot. But since that time, he has really had no symptoms. He pulled out an old a photograph, not on his phone, on like a real photograph, of his inflamed foot there, and it looks pretty typical for podagra. His blood pressure is 136 over 84. Presently on exam, he has no tophi to be found anywhere and really no arthritic changes. His labs showed a normal CBC, normal white count differential. His creatinine was 1.3, and his lipid numbers are there as you see. Again, probably a good indicator of metabolic syndrome. His high sensitivity CRP is 22, and his A1C was 6.3%. As I recall, he was not on any anti-hyperglycemic medications. So here's a man who's got an extensive cardiovascular history. He certainly has risk factors. He looks like he has metabolic syndrome, and he's got hyperuricemia and a remote history of gout. So the question was, what would you do? What would I do? Would you just advise, take care of your diet like you're doing to manage your cardiovascular risk factors? Or would you jump in with urate-lowering therapy? Would you go with low-dose allopurinol at 100 milligrams a day? Would you go to a more substantial dose of allopurinol, 300 milligrams a day? Is this a person that is appropriate for febuxostat or Euloric at the lower dose of 40 milligrams a day? Would you use just a uricose uric agent, very mild, probenecid, or just take care of his cardiovascular risk factors with hypertension control, lipid management, and probably something for his glucose intolerance? So these were some considerations as I was speaking to this gentleman who came in for just hyperuricemia. Well, anyway, the metabolism of uric acid is very complicated, and so I kind of scoured the internet for the nastiest flow diagram I could find to illustrate that, and here it is. And so this is just purine metabolism, and this is really, really wonderful. You know, I was a chemistry and biochemistry major in college, and this thing even has the enzyme catalog numbers. How about that? So anyway, so I just want you to focus down here on uric acid. This is one of the terminal steps of this huge cascade, which does include the urea cycle somewhere in the middle of the diagram and so forth. And I also want to call attention to these two points in which RNA and DNA both enter the cycle. So RNA and DNA made up of pyrimidines and, importantly, purines get metabolized, and those components enter this cycle. Eventually, uric acid is produced. As a result, if you flood the system with more RNA and DNA, most commonly by eating them, simply by mass action, you'll get a higher level of urate produced. Now, the other thing to focus on is here in the top left corner, which is the entry point for fructose. So fructose, as a simple sugar, also has an entry point into this metabolic cycle. And both epidemiologic data and biochemical data show that increased fructose intake can also lead to increased uric acid production. So there are three things to bear in mind. So focusing in on the uric acid part of it, we do know that its precursor is the compound known as xanthine. The conversion is through the enzyme known as xanthine oxidase, whereby it is converted to uric acid. Xanthine oxidase can be inhibited by our two available compounds, allopurinol and febuxostat. Those are the two xanthine oxidase inhibitors. Uric acid is broken down by the enzyme uricase, and as I mentioned, humans don't have uricase. However, we do have therapeutic uricase to convert uric acid to allantoin, which is a benign compound, and this happens by the administration of the compound known as pegloticase, which is a pegylated bacterial uricase that is commercially available and sometimes used by us in cases of severe tophaceous refractory gout to actually rid the person of uric acid and uric acid deposits. So there is a therapeutic intervention for that in the form of pegloticase. Now, I mentioned also that hyperuricemia is very much determined by the renal handling of uric acid. And this is just a little cartoon of the known proteins involved in uric acid transport. We do have a number that are in which genetic polymorphisms are well described, and they are associated with decreased function and therefore decreased uric acid secretion and recirculation in the blood. So polymorphisms, especially in several of these proteins, I'm just going to try to hit the back button here, and the pointer, I wonder if there is. Anyway, URAT1, the second from the top, and GLUT9B, they are important. There are many polymorphisms involved with that, and indeed, it's in some of the Southeast Asian populations that we see the most functionally disabled mutations of these proteins. So a lot of the so-called under-excretors have this as a background reason, polymorphisms in uric acid transport proteins in the kidney. So we'll focus in on gout for a moment. The gout prevalence is actually increasing worldwide, and this may be just because of globalization of diets and lifestyles that may be responsible for a global increase in gout incidence. I was in Southeast Asia not too long ago, not the Philippines, but in an area that was traditionally, that didn't have very much gout. I spent a day with one of my rheumatology colleagues, and she was telling me that she is seeing a lot more gout in her practice. In fact, that afternoon, it looked like there was just the walking wounded coming into the office, you know, a guy with his foot wrapped in a towel, similar to this gentleman, leaning on a broomstick because of an acute gout attack. So in the experience of individual practitioners, as well as global epidemiologic data, there is an increase in gout prevalence. Gout is a disease of uric acid accumulation. So the acute attacks that we are seeing are just the tip of the iceberg in a point in time. There's a huge background to that event, years and years, maybe even decades, of gradual uric acid accumulation to a critical point where then uric acid crystals have the opportunity to be shed into the joint space and then incite a very, very intense inflammatory reaction. So uric acid accumulation is a very useful concept in our thinking about how to approach gout and how to manage gout. Uric acid resorption, therefore, in order to reduce total body uric acid burden, is a long-term goal in therapy. Now, we do have some treat-to-target guidelines in the management of gout. The most widely adopted are those of the American College of Rheumatology, in which we state that the target serum uric acid concentration should be 6.0 milligrams per deciliter in males and 5.0 in females. If an individual does have chronic tophaceous gout, that number should actually be a bit lower in males. That should be 5.0 milligrams per deciliter. A couple of years ago, there was a little bit of a controversy with the American College of Physicians guideline that stated that there was no need to treat to target and that there was only a need to resolve acute attacks. And that was because of an understanding that allopurinol was rather a quite toxic drug and probably over-treatment would lead to hazard. The debate has gone back and forth. I think it has been somewhat resolved to demonstrate that allopurinol indeed is rather safe. Certainly in my experience, it's been a safe medication. The number of severe toxic allergic reactions and Stevens-Johnson syndrome that I've seen from allopurinol, I believe I can count on one hand in my experience from medical student days until now. So allopurinol generally is a very well-tolerated drug. There are some provisos that I'll mention in a moment. So the diagnosis of gout traditionally was a little bit nebulous, but the European Rheumatology Association tabled some guidelines and revised them just this year that are quite helpful in our making a diagnosis of gout, and it does not always require intra-articular synovial aspirate and crystal examination. High suspicion of gout can be forwarded if you have just a monoarticular involvement of inflammatory arthritis, especially of the lower extremity, such as the first MTP joint of the foot. Yes, you can have that kind of arthritis in other conditions, probably most commonly osteoarthritis that has the periodic little exacerbation, but other conditions seldom produce a very intense monoarthritis of the first MTP joint, so you're correct to suspect gout if you see that. Ankles are also surprisingly common, and the simple fact that these are the most distal parts of the body, they are the coolest places in the body, and it's just simple physical chemistry. If you want to crystallize something out of solution, you cool it down. And so that little change in temperature makes these areas very at risk for acute exacerbations. If the person has had previous similar arthritic episodes, again, of similar or identical joints, that's a very high suspicion for gout. If they've got a rapid onset of severe pain and swelling, I mean, this is a painful looking picture. The breeze from a ceiling fan may be too much to bear for this individual, or the weight of a bed sheet, not to say of a proposal to put a needle into his toe and take fluid out. You don't make any friends that way. But anyway, this is a very severe, very painful arthritis, arguably the most painful arthritis there is, much more painful than rheumatoid, much more intense than rheumatoid. And if its onset is rapid and its resolution is also self-limited to within 7 to 10 days, that is really suspicious for gout. Certainly erythema, it's more common in males. They also tilt your thinking. There may be associated cardiovascular diseases and hyperuricemia, so the patient with metabolic syndrome. The other setting in which hyperuricemia is common is in psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. And so if you see these clinical features, there's a high suspicion for gout. Hyperuricemia alone, as you're aware, does not qualify for the diagnosis of gout. You need to have something clinical happen in the form of one of these acute attacks. The diagnosis of gout certainly is also very much confirmed by a synovial fluid aspirate and a crystal examination. We still have microscopes in our office, but certainly any laboratory is qualified to examine synovial fluid under a red polarizing microscope, in which you will hopefully see, well, this is an ideal picture, of this very, very bright needle-shaped crystal, and if you align it to the axis of the polarizer, It glows yellow in color. This is something physicists called negative birefringence. And it happens to be swallowed by a neutrophil. So that is all, it checks all the boxes for a uric acid crystal. If you see one of those, you've got the diagnosis. Oftentimes in an acute attack, they will be abundant. It looks kind of like computer wallpaper. It's so colorful. But that is what a uric acid crystal will look like. Of course, if it's tilted in a perpendicular axis to the polarizer, it will be positively birefringent, and it'll look kind of bluish and purplish. So depending on the axis of the polarizer. We've got other radiographic methods, such as ultrasound here. The ultrasound produces a very typical, what we call double contour sign. The first inner contour is the surface of the articular cartilage. The second contour is actually the uric acid overlaying it. So we have this kind of almost pathognomonic sign by ultrasound, and many of us are doing that in the office to confirm the diagnosis of gout. The other technique that we have is dual energy CT scan. This is a very convenient and more widespread technique. It uses a conventional CT scanner in which new software is installed. There's one more module that ends up shooting a simultaneous second beam of another frequency in addition to your conventional X-ray frequency. And what that causes is a resonance in uric acid crystals. And so the computer can pick that up and can color, can do 3D reconstructions and can color uric acid whatever color you like. And here the computer is coloring uric acid crystals green. And so in this patient, we can see an abundance of uric acid accumulation around the first MTP joints. We may or may not have known that clinically, but it's also interesting that we're always surprised by the extent of uric acid accumulation outside of involved joints. For example, in this patient, the right ankle contains uric acid deposition. The lateral part of the right foot has uric acid deposition. And then in another study on the left-hand panel, you can see uric acid deposited in the Achilles tendon in the top portion. It's verified there. But in addition, the extensor tendons of that foot also contain pretty abundant uric acid. So uric acid accumulates over time. It's sitting there. It grows until there's a critical mass. And then some event, such as low temperature, another bolus of purines and pyrimidines through a steak and lobster dinner, a binge of alcohol to prevent uric acid secretion, and bang, you've got that critical moment where you can have shedding of crystals into the joint and joint membranes. So additional considerations in the management of gout, and here are where the nuances come in as we're managing gout. In everybody who presents with gout, for sure, we're going to be looking at their kidney function. It used to be that everybody needed a 24-hour urine collection for creatinine clearance and so forth. We seldom do that anymore. It has not been shown to be that beneficial in changing management. But certainly the presence of chronic kidney disease is an important consideration as a risk factor for uric acid deposition. Being overweight, certain medications, including thiazide diuretics, low-dose aspirin, and in the transplant and inflammatory realm, cyclosporin, tacrolimus, those are both inhibitors to uric acid secretion. Certainly, alcohol consumption can be a risk factor. Beer, as you know, has a lot of purines in it. Non-diet sodas have been associated, as well as meat and shellfish. Dietary things that have been proven to be protective include dairy. So that has been shown to be somewhat associated with a lower risk of hyperuricemia. Also, comorbidities such as obesity, renal impairment, we've mentioned hypertension and ischemic heart disease, just like the case that we've been considering, need to be considered, because I think that these can also be grouped in with metabolic syndrome and the risk managed globally. As I mentioned, uric acid will precipitate at a concentration of 6 milligrams per deciliter. So our target serum uric acid level should be at least that or lower at 37 degrees and pH 7.4. So it's pure physical chemistry. You've got the right temperature, concentration, and acid-base milieu, and you can have precipitation. So therefore, lowering the concentration certainly will lead to not only a decreased risk of precipitation, but actual dissolution of crystals, and therefore a decreased burden of uric acid in the tissues. So therefore, we table our serum uric acid guidelines. So this is another image of a very, very severe case of tophaceous gout and its corresponding dual energy CT image. You can see the massive accumulations of uric acid across all of the small joints of the hands and in the wrist. This is certainly very, very destructive. I don't think I brought a plain radiograph, but chronic gout is not only erosive on a plain X-ray, but it is also lytic. So there are not only erosions from synovium being expanded and eating into bone, there's actually bone lysis from an expanding tophus within the center of the bone that's growing and kind of just drilling out a hole in the middle of the bone. Those images are always quite impressive. So I use this analogy of an avalanche. So we've got this snowpack kind of accumulating over a season or two, more and more snow, and then somebody sneezes in the valley, and there you go, you got this gout attack. So what we're trying to do therapeutically is gradually, carefully melt away that snowpack. You know, don't go in there with a blast of dynamite. Don't poke it too hard. Take care and do it very gently, and hopefully that will, over time, reduce the risk of a uric acid precipitation and the gout attack. So what we recommend, and many of the society guidelines recommend, is to begin an agent like allopurinol at low dose, 100 milligrams a day, in order to minimize this chance of what we call an initiation flare. An initiation flare is akin to being too aggressive in melting that snowpack. And when you do that, you could set off an avalanche. So guideline is begin at low dose, 100 milligrams a day, both for tolerability, but also to minimize a chance of a flare. You may cover initiation flares with short-term NSAIDs, short-term colchicine, or short-term glucocorticoids, just to see them through, but then you're going to bring them back and have a uric acid level determined in about 6 weeks. And if they're not at target, gradually titrate this upward in 100 milligram increments. Again, we're doing this gently, and then we're periodically surveying their serum uric acid concentration and then going up. A lot of us don't know that the actual maximum daily dose for allopurinol is 800 milligrams a day. So a lot of folks are underdosed. I have quite a few patients who are above 300 milligrams. I think, you know, because the tablets are made in 100 and 300 milligram tablets, you know, we somehow think that that's the maximum. Anyway, I have plenty of patients on 500 or 600 milligrams, a few on 800 milligrams, and that's what they need in order to keep their uric acid concentration controlled. So carefully, of course, titrate the dose upwards, but do use enough until they get to target. As I mentioned, hypersensitivity reactions are rare, but of course the patient should be informed that the first signal of pruritus or just feeling unwell, you need to stop the allopurinol, call me, come in, and we will look after things. Another nuance, but a very important one that has come to light in the last 5 years, is that there is now a genetic allele identified that is a risk factor for hypersensitivity reactions with allopurinol, and this is HLA-B5801. These tests are commercially available. I know Quest Diagnostics has it. So just like HLA-B27 for spondyloarthropathy is commercially available, this should be tested in Asian populations, particularly Koreans, Japanese, Thai, and Han Chinese, that's me, and in black populations as well. So that should be a precursor, and risk factor screening should the intention be to treat with allopurinol. In chronic kidney disease, the guideline is to exercise caution with the dosing of allopurinol, but more recent studies have really cast doubt on the association of more hypersensitivity reactions in those with chronic kidney disease. Nonetheless, the guideline still says don't go beyond 300 milligrams per day, according to the American College of Rheumatology. Also a caution in the inflammatory and transplant world, the interaction of both xanthine oxidase inhibitors, allopurinol and febuxostat, with azathioprine. The levels of azathioprine go up quite dramatically in the presence of these drugs. So again, a caution in our management. Febuxostat is an alternative xanthine oxidase inhibitor. Unfortunately, it is only manufactured in two tablet sizes, a 40 milligram and 80 milligram. Side effects are quite a bit higher when you go above 80 milligrams per day. So it's not as titratable, but it is quite effective in lowering uric acid. It's more potent than allopurinol. But then there is this controversy about an increased cardiovascular risk with the use of febuxostat. I'll get into that in a little bit of detail in a moment. Probenecid is a uricose uric agent. It's weak and cannot be used with chronic renal insufficiency and GFR of less than 35 just because it needs to be secreted in order to work. So in those with impaired renal function, probenecid will not be a good choice. There used to be an agent on the market known as lesinurad or Zurampic. It is now off the U.S. market. The manufacturer cites low sales for the reason. It was an adjunctive treatment that we would use with a urate-lowering agent for allopurinol non-responders. I believe in Asia and Europe it's still available. And then losartan, the ARB, does have weak uricose uric effects, so that if you are going to choose antihypertensive therapy in a patient who also has hyperuricemia, losartan is uniquely positioned as a pretty good choice. Now, getting to this controversy about febuxostat and cardiovascular mortality, this was published about a year and a half ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this was the so-called CARES study, or cardiovascular safety of febuxostat or allopurinol in patients with gout and cardiovascular disease. And the impetus for this study was that in the several clinical trials of febuxostat in gout dating back to 2009, each one of those studies did note a slightly increased prevalence of cardiovascular complications with febuxostat use. So the FDA approved febuxostat for the treatment of gout because there was an unmet need, but they also mandated a larger safety study in cardiovascular disease. And so this study was carried out, which was a double-blind prospective study involving 320 centers in North America and 6,200 patients. And they were either randomized to Uloric or allopurinol and monitored over a number of years to look for cardiovascular complications, including death, MI, stroke, or unstable angina that needed intervention. So the outcomes are listed in this table, and I just want to focus your attention on the fact that, yes, indeed, there was a very, very slight increase in the primary endpoint, but not statistically significant in the febuxostat group. There were 242 events out of almost 3,100 patients in febuxostat group, and then in about the same N, 238 events. So this did not reach statistical significance. It looked quite encouraging. The puzzling thing was that in each of the categories of cardiovascular death, there was definitely more in the febuxostat group. In the death from any cause, there was also an enrichment in the febuxostat group. So while the primary endpoint was the same, the subgroups of cardiovascular death and all-cause mortality showed that there were more events in the febuxostat group, which was a little bit puzzling and mysterious in the final analysis. We really didn't come out too far ahead in terms of this study informing us. Now, one feature of this study is that even though the curves of mortality did separate at about the starting at about the two-year mark, you can see at the bottom of the slide the number of participants, or what we call the number at risk, dropped off dramatically from the baseline recruitment levels. At baseline, there were nearly 3,100 patients in each group. By month 24, that had decreased by fully one-third. So that, you know, in clinical trials and in clinical studies qualifies as really bad retention, like really bad retention. And by the end of 5 years, there was only 20% of the participants remaining. So there's ongoing work to examine why there were so many dropouts. Was there anything particular with those that were retained that then somehow changed the outcome of the study kind of midway through the study? In fact, the study investigators noted this even while they were conducting the study, and they did note that there were so many lost to follow-ups and dropouts from this study that they actually hired a private investigator to look for these additional cardiovascular deaths. I've never heard of that before. In disability cases, yes, but not in clinical studies. Anyway, they found an extra almost 200 deaths in patients that had dropped out from the study. They factored that in the intent to treat analysis, but they did not find that there was any. They found as a result that the febuxostat group was not significantly higher in mortality than allopurinol. So again, it kind of dirties the mixture a little bit and causes the interpretation to be very unclear. So the recommendation, however, still is that we can use febuxostat very cautiously, especially in those patients with pre-existing cardiovascular disease. More recently, a meta-analysis was independently performed out of my colleagues in New York. They examined 347 published trials that had head-to-head comparisons between febuxostat and allopurinol. This approximately one dozen studies were selected for analysis because of their quality. And the forest plot here on the right shows that really there does not seem to be any increased mortality and major cardiovascular outcome with febuxostat use, at least in this study. That blue square is the CARE study, and then the black diamond, of course, is the composite outcome from this meta-analysis. So in my practice, I still use febuxostat, but yes, I am very, very aware of the potential cardiovascular implications. As with other areas of medicine, including rheumatology, we are using biologic therapies more and more. Interleukin-1 monoclonal antibodies are on the market for other indications and not yet FDA approved for the treatment of acute gout. But even in my experience, I have used both anakinra and canakinumab in the acute setting, usually it's somebody in the ICU or critical care who has many, many cardiovascular comorbidities, is diabetic, and just cannot, in whom we cannot use colchicine or corticosteroids or NSAIDs for treatment of acute gout. On those occasions, biologic treatment has been shown to be helpful. As I mentioned, uric acid accumulation is at the heart of gout, and therefore we have uricase biologics, pegloticase and raburicase are both pegylated uric acid that we can infuse on occasion for patients with gout. The difficulty is that they are both bacterially derived, potentially very antigenic, and so allergic reactions, if not immediately, but down the road, are pretty common with both of these. So best left to experienced infusion centers and rheumatologists who have experience in administering these medications. The presence of hyperuricemia is important in the development of hypertension. We do know that there is an association between increased serum urate and intracellular urate with activation of the renal angiotensin system, with increased oxidative stress, decreased nitric acid levels in the endothelium, and more smooth muscle proliferation, which all contribute to blood vessel constriction and the development of hypertension. So there is an association there. The molecular steps are still being worked out, and clinically we observe this too, such as in this busy slide, a lot of studies to show that serum uric acid is indeed correlated with hypertension. So these are a lot of epidemiologic studies dating back to the 70s into this era that demonstrate that. Well, if we intervene, what happens? And this is a sample study in hypertensive youths, adolescents, who were randomized to either placebo or allopurinol. These subjects had hyperuricemia and hypertension, but not clinical gout. So they were not symptomatic of gout, but they got allopurinol. And as you can see, over 12 months, there appears to be an overall trend toward a lowering of blood pressure in those individuals that received allopurinol. So smaller studies such as this seem to contribute some ideas that there are some widespread metabolic effects and benefits that can be realized with allopurinol. In this study, rather small, of about 70 patients, we can see that the use of allopurinol in asymptomatic hyperuricemia versus placebo, and this is that left-hand column, is associated not only with a decrease in serum uric acid, but also in carotid intimal thickness and in many parameters associated with carotid hyper, dynamics, flow dynamics, as well as systemic blood pressure. So again, some more data to suggest that there can be these metabolic benefits. If we use allopurinol, if we study patients with hyperuricemia and their overall risk for cardiovascular events, we can see that allopurinol is additive to cardiovascular risk. The area under the curve of the dotted line are the traditional risk factors. They increase the so-called area and therefore the risk of cardiovascular disease. This is augmented with the presence of hyperuricemia as indicated in red. Finally, in glucose intolerance, again, studies have shown that if we intervene with uric acid lowering, we can lower systolic and diastolic blood pressure. We can improve albuminuria. We have a higher GFR in those patients that receive allopurinol, and we have less progression of insulin resistance and serum hypertriglyceridemia. Also, one of the clinical outcomes of diabetic nephropathy seemed to be less and correlated with albumin excretion in patients who, over this 3-year period, who had type 2 diabetes, received allopurinol, even for asymptomatic hyperuricemia. So in summary, I hope to have informed you about the effects of hyperuricemia in arthritic diseases, particularly gout, but also in cardiovascular and metabolic disease. The evidence that's available does imply that all of these domains are positively impacted with uric acid lowering. For sure, larger observational studies, larger clinical trials will be needed to confirm them. Also, I've pointed out that febuxostat may have some independent cardiovascular risk. Even large studies have not definitively defined that, but we do have this observation, and therefore we need to exercise some caution. So getting back to our case of this 70-year-old man who's had bad heart disease and sustained hyperuricemia, could I get a show of hands maybe from the audience? Who would just advise dietary changes? Who would actually go with low-dose allopurinol in this man? So the majority of the audience, and actually that's what I elected to do, because he's got hyperuricemia, he's got cardiovascular risk factors. There is a little bit of evidence, and so to carefully titrate up allopurinol was my decision, not to start with higher dose, and then, of course, because he's got bad heart disease, I would prefer not to use febuxostat, and probenecid probably is too weak to do that. So I will end here. Oh, these are just my rationale. I'm saying I'm pretty comfortable with managing allopurinol. So Thank you for your attention. I'll be available for questions. Yes, question behind Dr. Rosenthal. And then Dr. Rosenthal, yes. There is some weak evidence, yes, but I would have to underscore weak. Most of the studies have been done in patients who don't have gout yet are hyperuricemic. So the body of evidence is there. There are a few studies. I mean, the largest one is about 100 patients who have metabolic syndrome, who do not have gout or hyperuricemia, in whom allopurinol benefited their outcomes in a number of measurements in metabolic syndrome. So, yeah, we may have to expand our thinking to using them even without hyperuricemia. Ken.
So I have a patient I've been taking care of for about 20 years who has Crohn's disease, and he was on 6-mercaptopurine, which is
azathioprine, right.
And anyway, he developed gout, and he started in college, said, I really feel weak, and I'm running fevers. Mm.
Hmm.
And what happens is that the xanthine oxidase pathway, if you add allopurinol to 6-mercaptopurine or azathioprine, you increase the production of 6-thioguanine, mm-hmm. which is a bone marrow depressant.
Yeah.
And we actually use that at times for people who have Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, but we're trying to titrate the 6-mercaptopurine and allopurinol. Mm.
That's interesting. That's an interesting practice.
To manipulate patients' metabolic
pathway. Uh-huh. Yeah, it's a real phenomenon. It's a very potent phenomenon, and more often than not, we're trying to skirt away from that combination. But it's interesting to hear that you actually use it therapeutically sometimes. Any other questions? Yes, sir. So if there is a person who has chronic kidney disease and happens to be on allopurinol and you observe that their kidney disease is worsening, when do you switch away from allopurinol? That's a very good question. There's really no hard guideline, and it's really I personally use a 20%. If the creatinine, serum creatinine, increases by 20%, then from their stable baseline, then I really consider a change. But like I mentioned, this area is also a little bit debatable now, whether there's actually an increased risk of hypersensitivity or other complications. But I still use that guideline personally. But there isn't anything published about that. Thank you. Yes?
Sorry, for a second question. Has the ketogenic diet increased the incidence of
gout? There's one study that shows that it has. You know, red meats are a huge a purine load, and so diets like that that are high in red meats or in processed meats certainly increase serum uric acid. One study that was based on the behavioral risk factor database showed that that kind of dietary intake is associated with increased gout. So there's never a free lunch. You always get some complications. Okay, if there aren't any, I'll be available at the front. Thank you very much.